Hey, I'm going to invite you to Genesis 34 is where we're at together today. Genesis chapter 34. And I need to really prepare our hearts for this kind of a passage. I'm just going to be frank in saying, honestly, if I could just kind of skip past this chapter today, I would do it. But we as a church like to go through the books of the Bible. What we teach what's called expository teaching, which is walking through chapter by chapter, verse by verse, the books of the Bible. That's not every message that we do, but the majority of messages that we teach is that way. And the reason we like to do it like that as a church is so that you don't get taught heresy. We want you to understand the truth of who God is. It is far easier to just cherry pick verses out of the Bible to teach an agenda, kind of weaponize God's word for what you want it to say rather than what God actually says. And expository teaching is one of those safeguards to God's community that we can look at God's word together and learn and grow. One of the things I think is important that I say here at the beginning is, look, I am not a trauma counselor. If someone here is in need of that kind of resource, we know where those resources are that we can help point people to those things. I have, because of the nature of what we're going to talk about today, I have listed some Christian writers that are more are better equipped in this field than I am to deal with areas of trauma if you're interested in reading, as well as there's a couple books on sexual purity for those that might struggle with, say, things like pornography. A couple of those resources at the bottom of your notes. If you didn't pick up notes today, if you download the Alpine Bible Church app and click on the sermon notes, you'll see that these notes are listed there as well, along with resources. But by the nature of what we're talking about today, we're dealing with an event that not only leads to harm of a young lady, but it also leads to the destruction of a group of people, to a society. And I think what's important for us as we engage this text, and especially guys, I think I want to particularly highlight this for you, is that every male in this story that we're about to encounter, there's several men we're going to read about, but every male in this story fails in some way. And so we're going to approach this as we look at the negativity of this story to really respond by saying, what can we do differently? When the gospel transforms our life, what is it God calls us to do in this world in order to make a difference? Because what Jesus does in you, he desires to do through you. That this isn't something that just sits with you, but when you understand who you are in light of who Christ is, not only does it give you worth and value, but it gives you purpose in the way that you live. And then you also then have the opportunity to honor the value in other people. And Genesis 34 is one of those chapters where people have failed a young lady and failed an entire society. And so we want to ask the question, how can we do it differently? And in Genesis chapter 34, verse 1, you see how this story starts. Very heavy story, but it says, "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, who was born to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land." If you remember where we are to this point, we've been following the character that is Jacob, who is off in the area where Laban lived, Padan Aram, and he's living in this area. He finds a wife. God calls him back after 20 years to go back to the promised land. Jacob knew there was no future for him in the land where Laban lived because Laban was a deceiver, taking advantage of him over and over again, and God had called his people to belong to the promised land. So he returns to this promised land, and he doesn't, we'll look in a minute, doesn't go exactly where God had called him to in that promised land, but he's returned there, and we've learned Jacob now has multiple sons. He's going to have one more born here in just a few, but he's got he's going to have a dozen sons, I should say, and then he's also got a daughter, and this is the only daughter that we read about or that we know about. Her name is Dinah. And Dinah, being one girl among all these boys, she desires companionship with other females. Nothing wrong with that. She's probably in her teens, maybe early 20s when this is taking place. And so her desire is to be with other young ladies. And so she goes out to visit with other young ladies in the land. And then verse 2, "And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her." So here you see in this story, it's very honest with what's taking place here. Verse 31 goes on, elaborates in another way. Rather than just humiliating her, it says in verse 31 that she was treated like a prostitute. And so what's being described in this story is Dinah is raped. And, you know, when I look at this, these first couple of verses, this young lady is not doing anything wrong. You know, hindsight, it would have been wonderful if she had other people there that could have guarded her and protected her. But there should be nothing wrong with a young woman moving freely in her own land, trying to just meet other young women. And as a guy reading this passage, you know, I don't understand what it's like to walk in this world as a woman. It just, there's always, I think, for women, different than guys, there's just this kind of low-lying fear for your own protection and safety everywhere you walk in this world. Right? You, somewhere in a parking lot, you park your car, you get out, you try to be aware of what's around you. And that should not be the kind of society that women have to live in. Right, but it's just by nature of the darkness of this world where we find ourselves. And here in this story, you find this young lady has been taken advantage of. You know, and reading about her own story, it made me curious about even some of the statistical information about our own country and where we find the safety of women, especially in concerns of protection of her sexuality from any sort of assault. And in an organization that's called the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, they gave some statistics regarding the sexual violence that takes place in our country. It says this: 1 in 5 women and 1 in 71 men will be raped at some point in their lives. 91% of the victims of rape and sexual assault are female. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before they turn 18 years of age. 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. Rape is the most underreported crime in our country. 63% of sexual assaults go unreported to police. Only 12% of child sexual abuse is reported to the authorities. And then on top of all that, false reporting is estimated somewhere between 2 to 10%. So that's just dealing with our own country. And what's, I think, worth pointing out as well is when you go to more impoverished areas of this world, those statistics drastically increase. And when you go to places in this world where they can't afford police, or there are no police, period, because they can't support it within their own context, those statistics improve astronomically. I remember I was talking to a lady from another country, and I was particularly concerned with, there were these group of young ladies in this country I'd gotten to know, and I was particularly concerned for their safety. And I remember I was talking to this lady about these young women, and one of those young ladies was taken back from this place that I considered somewhat safe to a situation that I think made her more vulnerable. And I remember expressing this to this lady, and I said, I'm really worried about her safety and someone violating her. And this woman, who is usually particularly composed, she doesn't say a lot, she looks back at me and says, that's going to happen. I don't want you to think that there's a possibility that isn't going to happen. That's definitely going to happen. It's more of when it's going to happen and how often it's going to happen. And it just shocked me. I know in traveling to parts of this world, especially areas that are significantly impoverished, that is an issue that we are constantly addressing, in especially among the young men and the way they treat young ladies. But just hearing that shocked me. In fact, I'll say, when we take mission trips as a church, we have one coming up in the fall. When we take mission trips of the church, one of the things that's difficult for me, and I know team members when they come back, is how to deal with looking at the wealth of our country and how people choose to live. And then you look at other parts of this world when you recognize just a small fraction of that money can make such a significant difference in this world. Like, I'm not saying that trying to make you feel guilty over the things you possess, okay? but I want you to know that there is accountability with the things that we own. I don't know. There we go. Yeah. Sometimes I say things and the Spirit of God just moves. Just kidding. But But looking at stories like this, I think it's important to stir our own hearts for what it is that God can do with us here and now. Like, we can't change this, but the Lord certainly wants us to be aware of this, because we have an opportunity in the time period in which we live and the places where we find ourselves in order to make a difference. And by the way, this isn't just talking about the idea of morality. This is when you understand how God has created everyone in his image. And not only that, he's also died for us, giving us a greater worth than anything in this world can offer. How you live in light of that matters, because it's demonstrating that truth that you've embraced and whether or not you have embraced it. And so what you believe about who you are in light of who God is should impact the way that you live in this world. That's the gospel transforms us, that God would pursue us in our own brokenness, that he made us in his image. He remakes us at the cross where he died for us. And God wants to move in our lives to glorify him and to honor other people. When God created us in the beginning, he said, be fruitful, multiply, and bless, subdue. And so the idea is this, that we would take care of what God has given us. But as you mature in life, the extent by which you have opportunity to, let's say, make a difference by managing the things that God puts in front of you, can continue to not only care for those things, but also to develop it and further in such a way that it continues to bless people around us. So how do we do that? And the story goes on, verse 3. And his soul, talking about Shechem, by the way, they're in the town of Shechem right now, and there's this young man named Shechem who's violated Dinah, and his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this girl for my wife. Let me just say, this passage is absolutely disgusting. I mean, to think about this young man now taking advantage of this woman, and the way that he wants to caveat what he's experienced is, I love her. And his behavior certainly does not display that, right? This idea of love in his mind is very much a warped idea. I think in our culture, we even treat love in a way that I think is, we'll say, unique from what the Bible communicates. We'll use the word love like it's a junk drawer word. Like, we'll say things like, you know, I love my wife, and then turn around in the very next sentence and say, I love chicken wings, right? And that is not, that those two things are not the same thing, right? Or at least I hope they're not the same thing. That you might have an appreciation for chicken wings, but that is not what love really is. Love is unconditional, sacrificial. 1 Corinthians 13, it does not think of its own well-being, but rather the well-being of others. It's about laying your life down for the benefit of others. That's biblical love. It's sacrificial. You see that with Jesus on the cross. He didn't do that for him. He did that for you. Jesus giving his life for our well-being. That's the biblical picture of love. What this young man is doing is he's feeding his own lustful desires. That's not love. But this is the way it's described in this narrative, how this young man engages in this story. And I realize in just these first few verses, there is a weight of trauma described. And in talking about a passage like this, look, I think it's important to say, I don't want to be trite towards people's experiences and what they've endured. And I don't just want to give a Band-Aid verse and say, just take two of these verses and just be better. When you go through difficult things like this, it takes time to nurture a healthy heart, especially before the Lord. But I think it's also important to say, what happens to you does not define you. That what Christ has done for you places far more worth on us. It's important to learn your true identity, because we act out according to what we believe. And so letting the truthfulness of what God says refresh our soul in him becomes important to combating the darkness of our world. And one of the unfortunate things when I read a story like this that I find with where our culture is today, for some reason, we've popularized the idea of making everyone a victim. And because everyone in our culture gets pushed or promoted as a victim, it really devalues people that are real victims and getting them the help that they need. when they go through traumatic experiences. I mean, if I gave you an example, something like this, I could say, look, if you're a young adult or a college student living in your mommy's basement and you're triggered by the fact that people won't use the pronouns that you want them to refer to yourself, you're not a victim, right? I mean, you're in a situation in life where you need to grow up a little bit and understand not everyone's going to say what you want them to say. And that is different than going through an experience that makes you, that's trauma that causes you to be a victim. And so there's importance to giving real victims the opportunity to getting the help that they need. And so these passages are certainly weighty, but as we look at this, I want us to understand that this the type of culture that's created in this environment doesn't just bring the destruction of this young lady, it also leads to the destruction of the society around her, which we'll see in just a little bit. And so I want us to think about, in light of the darkness that is around us, what are three gospel-centered ways that we as believers can help prevent the destruction of society? What is it when the gospel transforms our life? How is it that we can work in a society to see these kinds of things fought against? And maybe we could say it the other way. How can I promote the health of a society knowing that darkness is here? Point number one in your notes is this: reject passivity as followers of Christ. Reject passivity as followers of Christ. God made you for a purpose and to cultivate that until the goodness of the Lord in this world. We have to be willing and ready to reject passivity as followers of Christ. Verse number 5, Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah. But his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the fields. As soon as they heard of it, the men were indignant and very angry because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter. For such a thing must not be done. Now, at first glance of this story, it actually looks like what Jacob is doing is very wise. Right, because you think in this society, in this region, they're outnumbered. They're the outsiders that have moved into this land. There is no police force. And so if retributive justice is going to be administered, Jacob is wise not to open his mouth immediately, but rather wait for his sons to come back from the field. It looks like he's waiting for them in order to respond the way that God would be honored in responding to this. But unfortunately, that's not what Jacob does. Jacob takes the role of passivity, and no doubt this is a difficult situation. All right, but there's a couple of ways that we see as Jacob is stepping in this moment. He is not stepping in a way according to the Lord and what God would desire. The first way that we know this is that by being in Shechem, Jacob is in a place that God did not call them, which is outside the hand of really God blessing them. What I mean is, when Jacob was in the land of Laban, in Genesis chapter 31, verse 13, God told him to go back to the promised land, which Jacob did. But God specifically told him to go to the place of Bethel, not Shechem. And Jacob ignored that. God repeated it again in Genesis 35, verse 1. So it's like Jacob is kind of leading his family, but not fully leading his family. He's not being completely the kind of man that God had called him to be. And not only that, when this situation is finally confronted, Jacob doesn't take the lead in this as the father. Rather, he leans into his sons to do something about it. And when his sons do something about it, Jacob decides he doesn't like what they did. And then he responds to it all in verse 30 and 31. He says, "Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, 'You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household.' But they said, 'Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?'" So the sons are saying, look, something should have happened. But Jacob, when he finally engages the problem, what you see from Jacob, the only person that he's worried about is himself. Right, nowhere in this passage does he talk to his daughter about what's happened to her. Does he figure out how to work through this messy situation with her? All he does is he sits back passively for the young men to show up. And when they finally show up, he gets responds in a negative way in how they chose to handle it. Saying in this situation, Jacob is certainly taking this role of passivity. And guys, can I tell you, particularly as men, there are two ways that God would call you to respond in this world. And ladies, this will broadly apply to you too, proactively and reactively. There's a time to be proactive and reactive. There's certain things counselors refer to as preventative counseling, which you just instill healthy things into your family, right? You nurture certain things within the life of your family, not to wait to just react to everything, but to build up. You know, one of the most beautiful ways I think that can happen is fathers, when you nurture the heart of your daughters, you want to raise the standard high in what she should expect from a young man and the treatment she should receive. And that's modeled by how you treat her and ultimately demonstrated by the way you treat her mother. And when you give that sort of respect, it elevates for her what to expect from a young man. That's called being proactive in our concern and care. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 2, it says, treat older women as mothers, younger women as sisters in all purity. Honor widows who are truly widows. I mean, it helps us deal with the fact, maybe the reality of, if godly men don't respond, evil men will not stop. God has called you into this world to be proactive. When you experience the transformation of the gospel and you understand the identity for which you have because of Christ, you can respond in that, honoring the dignity in other people, being made in his image and recreated for the purposes of Christ. If there's something within us that does not desire to protect the weak and rise up against injustice, then there's something that's broken. To reject passivity is what God calls us to. Point number two, honor people as image bearers of God. Honor people as image bearers of God, not as objects. God made them, God died for them, and how important it is for us to show our love for the Lord by demonstrating honor towards other people. Made in God's image, one of the greatest ways to worship the Lord is seen in the way you treat other people, not viewing them as objects, but viewing them as image bearers of God. Now, anytime a person looks at someone else lustfully, you're looking at the thought of treating someone else as a tool for your own personal pleasure. Now, certainly within the marriage relationship, Hebrews 13:4, if you want a verse, right, the marriage relationship, it is undefiled. Hey, God created your sexuality for a reason. There's certainly delight in that, intimacy developed in that. You want to appreciate the purpose which God has created that. But with those gifts come responsibilities. That doesn't mean if you're attracted to ladies, that every lady becomes a tool for your purposes and pleasures. Rather, it's an opportunity to honor the dignity and worth in which God has created her. But this is what you see in the life of Hamar and his son Shechem. Right? They've really raised a generational mindset of degrading women by treating them as tools. They've created this predatorial behavior from one generation to the next. Verse 8, but Hamar spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us. The land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it and give property in it. Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say, I will give. Ask me for a great, verse 12, ask me for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife. I mean, this passage really is disgusting. And you think what they're saying in these verses is, look, we treated your daughter like a tool. You've got some other attractive ladies there. How about we just treat all the women like tools? Let's just swap them around for our own personal pleasure, and we'll treat them as objects rather than as human beings. And so you see this predatorial mindset that's been taught from one generation to the next, degrading the value of women being image bearers of God as property to be owned, rather than the people to be cherished. You know, it's interesting. There was a study done by this young lady named Jessica Reyes, and she was studying the male brain as they interacted with females. And the way she approached the study was actually through bathing suits, honestly. And she started to do this study looking at the way bathing suits have changed throughout the decades. And she came to this point where she recognized that as bathing suits changed, there was this time period where when the bikini became popular, the way they popularized it was to pay prostitutes to wear it, to then attract other people to start wearing that fashion. And as they did a study on male brains, they started to bring females around with, I guess, less clothing. And what they began to recognize with men is that when they looked at females lustfully, that the part of their brain that was triggering was the same part of their brain that triggers when they grab a tool from the garage. That rather than look at them as image bearers of God to be honored, they looked at them as objects for their own purposes to be used. Guys, there is a battle that happens within all of us for the integrity and worth of every human being to be honored by the way that you conduct yourself. And, you know, for us as a church, one of the things that when we choose to do works in this world, we like to go out to places where we want to instill in a group of people a generational change. Right? One of the reasons we go to Uganda. We go to one of the most impoverished areas, a place where human sacrifice is the highest, where children are taken advantage of, for the purpose of working with young people to see a generational change, a generational mindset made different through the gospel, that every human being is made in the image of God. Specifically, in terms of lust in that battle, Job said this in Job 31, verse 1, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a young woman, for what is our lot from God above, our heritage from the Almighty on high? Hey, so he's saying, look, when I understand who I am, verse 2, in light of who God is, understanding what God has called us to, this is my commitment. And Job is saying, look, I'm attracted to women. Let's be honest, guys, right? Like, when it comes to ladies, they look better, right? They smell better. They just do everything better. They do it more gracefully. You just kind of grow hair in weird places and smell bad. That's kind of like your gift, right? But there's nothing wrong with appreciating beauty. But to do it lustfully, to degrade as if someone becomes an object or a tool for your pleasure, is to take away from the intrinsic worth that they have. And Job 31, he's saying, look, I'm making this covenant with my eyes to honor the image in everyone, specifically in women. And when you think in terms of covenant, I think that's a beautiful word Job picked. It's similar to the idea of a marriage covenant. It's saying, look, if you're married, you know, God's given me this attraction, and I'm taking this attraction, I'm honing it in to honor one person. That's the marital covenant, one person. As a husband, I want to honor my wife, right? That my duty towards her is to elevate her to the best of my abilities, because God has made her in his image, and I want to give my life for her benefit as she seeks to honor the Lord. You know, that's my duty. That's what covenant is. And so you make that covenant, right? But then you walk in that covenant. You continue to make that covenant every day. Same is true with Job 31. Job saying, look, I know for the purpose which God has created people. I want to honor that, especially in the distinction of male and female. So not only am I giving this statement, but I'm going to walk in this battle every day in the way I choose to honor the opposite sex. So purity becomes this battle, right? It's to make our aim to honor God, not gratify my flesh, but in honoring God, bless those around me. It's not about obsessing about not looking at pornography. I should probably say it like this. Like some people will think, okay, the goal is I'm bad if I look at porn, therefore I'm going to not look at porn, right? That's not the goal of the life of the believer. Like your success as a Christian is not based on how little porn you looked at. Your success as a Christian is living for the glory of God in this world. And in doing so, you'll move away from the things that are contrary to what it is God desires. that I live for his glory to the benefit of others. And part of that is understanding the intrinsic worth in every human being and the way that I treat them. But for Hamar in this story, he perpetuates a culture of a predator, as you see in his conversation, and specifically as he represents his son. Reject passivity. Honor people as image bearers of God. Point number three, live out the 6-8 principle. Live out the 6-8 principle. Now, I'll elaborate exactly what this is in just a moment, but I want us to think, you know, when we realize there's an injustice in this world or there's injustices happening, we have this tendency in our human nature to like slam the pendulum one way or the other. We either run to liberalism, and I don't mean this politically, I mean this antinomianally, like there's just no laws. Like people keep doing wrong things. Rather than try to help these people not do wrong things, we decide, let's just get rid of the law, right? That's liberalism. Or there's legalism, where you overcompensate. And in overcompensating, it leads, you'll find in this passage, to the destruction of an entire society. And we have the tendency to do one way or the other. We act in legalism or liberalism. Let me just say it like this. Let me remind you, Hebrews 13:4, right? It says to you, marriage should be honored by all and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and the sexually immoral. Sexuality is a gift. It's to be honored in the marriage bed, right? This is where God created it. And there's certainly delight in the sexuality and the intimacy that it creates. But there's a way in which God desires for us to experience it. And it's seen in how we treat one another in dignity and honor. And so when there's an injustice happen, we want to respond in a way of retributive justice, in a way that meets the crime or the injustice. Not ignore it. Not overcompensate, but walk according to the Micah 6:8 principle. And unfortunately, in this story, again, we see how the men fail as the young men respond to what happens to Dinah, her brothers. It says, the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition, we will agree with you that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we'll be gone. So the young men come to the people of the land of Shechem, and they're like, you want to marry our women, then you got to be circumcised. They come up with this. This is not their true plan. Circumcision is not really the issue. They're just trying, let's just say, to weaken the other tribe. And then all of the people agree to this. They're like, okay, guys, let's do this, right? So they all get circumcised. And we're going to skip ahead to verse 25 after 3 days. So after 3 days after their circumcision, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brother, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and whatever was in the city and in the field, all the wealth, all the little ones and their wives, all that was in the house they captured and plundered. So here's what it's saying. Because one crime was committed, they thought it was great to commit a bunch of crimes. That was their response, right? This is certainly an overcompensation. It's not to say justice shouldn't happen. Justice should have happened, right? But to punish everyone because of someone doesn't make it right. And instead, what you have, rather, is multiple wrongs. And I think we've seen this even in our own culture. We tend to overreact. Right? You go one side to the other. I mean, this year, you'll get a big dose of that. It's called politics, right? For the rest of this year, that's what you're going to live in, just this polarizing one side or the other. We even did this a few years ago in our country when we tried to popularize the idea of defunding the police. I gotta tell you, one of the stupidest things that you can do I can take you to cultures right now where there are no police and just let them say to us, do you think, we ask them a question, do you think it's a smart idea to get rid of police? Like, no, it's a dumb idea. Just because you may not like what someone did or someone did something wrong doesn't mean you punish everyone in the process. Right? There's a level by which we react. that fits the situation. Micah 6:8 is that Micah 6:8 principle, and this is the way God calls us to move in this world. When the gospel transforms us, when we see the value of human beings because God created us in his image and God died for us. Micah 6:8, I think, describes this beautifully. He says, he has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you? To do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. To do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. When you think about what that looks like in our life, I think one of the best ways to think about it is really take the word and move through it backwards. That as you're walking with God, right, God shows you what it means to love kindness. Some say love mercy. As you're walking with God, you grow in your mercy because you understand how merciful God has been to you. And you start to see people in those terms in that same mercy. You walk humbly with God, and you then start to act in that mercy. And in acting in that mercy, what you do is you do justice. You do justice. This is referred to as mishpat in Hebrew. It means retributive justice, meaning you don't ignore things. You don't overreact to things. But you're willing to step in the midst of darkness to help things find healing. God calls you into this world to live out that principle. As you walk with him, God works within your heart to develop a more merciful expression to the flight of human beings and the difficulty that we endure for the purpose of bringing about retributive justice, really healing justice to the brokenness of this world. So how does the gospel bring hope? And again, we think in terms of people that are victims. We don't want to be trite. We don't want to say, just quote Bible verses till you feel better. But rather to understand where they're coming from. To know that what happened to you does not define you. But rather understanding your identity in the Lord, because what you believe about yourself, you will live out. To understand the goodness for which Christ has come to set you free, and as a society, to give dignity and worth to other human beings in the way that we treat them, not as tools, not as objects, but as image bearers of God, recognizing in the way we treat people is worship before our Lord. There was a teacher who, he taught nurses, and on one of his final exams that he gave to his students, the last question he asked was, what is the name of the lady who cleans your classroom every evening? And the first student looked at that and kind of thought it was a joke and just left it blank and turned it in. And the next student came up and handed in their paper as well. And as the second student handed in their paper, asked the question, is that last question really going to count? Of which the teacher responded, absolutely. You're in the business of caring for people. And one of the greatest ways that you can care for someone is to acknowledge their presence, even if it's just a wave of the hand and a smile. Dignity and worth of every human being matters to God. He created them in his image. He gave his life for them. In fact, in 1 Peter chapter 2, it says this, live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. I mean, when you understand what the gospel means for us and the value that's been given to us and the opportunity we have to introduce other people to their creator who gave his life for them too, I mean, the idea of honoring people is intrinsic to the foundation of who we are. I'll close with this, but there's this passage in Revelation chapter 7 that happens to describe the persecution of God's people toward a period of time referred to as the Great Tribulation. God's people will endure the tribulation, right? We're promised you'll go through tribulation. But there's this period of time talked about in Revelation referred to as this great tribulation. It's this period of great suffering on God's people. And when you think about this word tribulation, like what comes to mind when you think of not just tribulation, hardship, but great tribulation, my mind really reflects on what happened in Israel just a few months ago. When people invaded that land and took hostages, the kind of stories that were told about what those hostages endured. You think in terms of the Great Tribulation, I don't think it's far off to assume or think that God's people in the future will endure a similar hardship. And so it says in Revelation 7:13, then one of the elders addressed me saying, who are these clothed in white robes and from where have they come? I say to him, sirs, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones coming out of the Great Tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Here's what it's saying. There's what happened to them in the Great Tribulation. But that is not who they are. Who they are is something far greater, and it's found in the Lord. That when the Lord sees us, he doesn't see the defilement of the world upon us, but rather the beauty of Jesus that has cleansed us. Now, the image of these white robes is to express the purity of God's people. That we mess up. We fail. We aren't perfect. But the defiling things of this world are not what define us. It's the beauty of Jesus who cleanses us. That when God sees us, he sees the purity of Christ. Guys, it is our privilege to take that dignity and worth that only Christ can give into this world in the midst of darkness, to honor people around us, to reject passivity, to not treat people as tools, but rather see them as image bearers of God. And in so doing, honoring the glory of God in this world.
This message has been brought to you by Alpine Bible Church in Lehi, Utah. If you'd like more information, please visit us online at alpinebible.com.